From KTOO in Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea with this news. Governor Mike Dunleavy is expected to release his proposed budget tomorrow. In it, he could revive several ideas that faced intense opposition last year, including deep budget reductions and big permanent fund dividends. But before Dunleavy's proposals can take effect, they have to make it through the state legislature. As Nat Herz with Alaska Public Media reports, that's far from guaranteed.
At a hangar in Anchorage in mid-December, business executives and labor leaders gathered to support the governor as he introduced a proposal that he pledged would permanently fix Alaska's budget problem.
Well, welcome. Good morning. Thank you all so much for being here.
Oh, sorry. Were you expecting to hear from Mike Dunleavy? That was actually Bill Walker, Dunleavy's predecessor, and the year was 2015. After approving substantial cuts in his first year in office, Walker still faced a deficit of more than $3 billion. At the hangar, he proposed a long-term fix that would restructure the permanent fund, reduce dividends, and raise money with an array of new and increased taxes.
I guarantee everybody in Alaska will find something about this plan they don't particularly care for.
Walker, an independent, was right about that. Democratic lawmakers were particularly opposed to smaller dividends, while Republicans objected to taxes. And Walker's whole package pretty much fell flat. While he proposed a number of bills to support his budget, the state legislature rejected all but one of them. Sound familiar? Let's fast forward 4 years to Mike Dunleavy's first year in office.
Today, I announced my administration's straightforward and open budget, a budget where expenditures equal revenues.
Dunleavy last year released a similarly ambitious proposal with record high permanent fund dividends and huge cuts to schools, healthcare, and the state university system. But the legislature's response was similarly lukewarm. By the time lawmakers finished debating the governor's plan, they'd sliced the PFD to $1,600, rejected the school's cut, and dismissed a separate plan to divert municipal oil tax revenue to the state. Veterans of the state's drawn-out budget process say that those events are worth keeping in mind this week as Dunleavy announces his proposed spending plan for next year. That plan has to go through the state legislature.
Well, I've been there when they actually took the governor's budget when he handed it out and just threw it in the garbage, and they started to write a new budget.
That's retired Republican legislator Mike Chenault, who served as House Speaker for 8 years. While the Alaska Constitution gives the governor expansive fiscal powers, the legislature, he says, still acts as an important check. And often the governor's success at imposing his vision depends on his ability to collaborate with the legislative branch, which Chenault says was practically non-existent last year.
In order to pass a budget that the governor wants, he's going to have the rapport with the legislators to be able to convince them that that's the right thing to do.
One more dynamic that can thwart a governor's goals is that one big piece of the budget is dictated by state and federal law. That's the case with the Medicaid health care program. Dunleavy and state legislators budgeted less money for that program this year, but because they didn't change the underlying rules about who's eligible, the state is spending more than it set aside. The governor does, however, have one final trump card over the budget process, his line item veto power, which retired Fairbanks political science professor Jerry Macbeth says is formidable.
That makes the governor's fiscal power greater than that of almost every other governor.
But even that power has limits. Lawmakers can override the governor's veto with a 3/4 vote. And while that's a high bar, they can also do what the legislature did last year after Dunleavy vetoed hundreds of millions of dollars from the state budget. They simply passed another bill adding money back. Look for a similar give and take to play out this coming year, too. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Herz.
Alaska lawmakers held a hearing today to learn more about how tribal compacting has worked in the state. Compacts are agreements between different governments, like between the state or federal governments and tribal organizations, to provide services. Governor Mike Dunleavy has said he wants to have compacts with tribes that cover public education, but his administration hasn't spelled out the details. Alaska Native compacting experts talked at a hearing in Anchorage about the benefits of compacting. Some sounded a note of caution related to the amount of money and authority the state is willing to turn over to tribes. Melanie Banke is the CEO of Kowarik, a tribal consortium in the Bering Strait region. She says tribes educated community members before the state imposed a system.
The systems have not been designed by us. They're not run by us, and they're not designed for us.
Banke says education compacting could allow tribal organizations to design curriculum and teaching methods that will serve their communities. Her organization provides Head Start and adult basic education, as well as other services. Former State Health Commissioner Valerie Nuralak-Davidson says compacting has led to improved services in areas like healthcare.
In every program in which a tribe or tribal organization has assumed services that were previously provided by someone external to that community, we have seen improvement.
But experts say the details of what the administration proposes will be important. Natasha Singh is the general counsel of the Tanana Chiefs Conference. She noted that the Indian Health Service turned over nearly all of its healthcare funding to tribal organizations in a compact.
If the state of Alaska thinks that it can turn over the responsibilities of the education system without the proper authority and funding to go along with it, we will not be successful.
The State Department of Education has said education compacting could start with a pilot program and expand from there. Local officials are pushing back against a plan to close Ketchikan State Trooper Dispatch Center and to relocate its 7 staff to Anchorage. The plan, which also includes transferring dispatchers in Wasilla and Soldotna, was the subject of much concern at the latest meeting of the Ketchikan Borough Assembly. The mayor believes that centralizing dispatch operations could leave Southeast communities high and dry in a disaster. KRBD's Eric Stone reports.
The Alaska Department of Public Safety told Ketchikan Gateway Borough staff in late November that it intends to close the local state trooper dispatch center. It plans to transfer the 7 dispatchers currently located in Ketchikan to a new facility in Anchorage by July of 2021. Those dispatchers take calls from the public and relay them to nearby state troopers. The planned closure is part of a wider effort to centralize dispatch operations. State troopers also plan to close dispatch facilities in Wasilla and Soldotna as part of the reorganization. Early estimates put cost savings at nearly $1 million. But one local official says relocating trooper dispatch facilities to Anchorage could have dire consequences in a disaster.
It's obviously a concern for us because it affects our citizens, represents a loss of state jobs on our island, could potentially diminish services, especially emergency response capabilities.
That's Ketchikan Gateway Borough Mayor and former state trooper Rodney Dial speaking during a borough assembly meeting in early December. He said that local knowledge is important for regional dispatchers as they assist troopers in responding to emergency calls. He also said the dispatch center in Ketchikan serves as an important backstop in case a disaster, like an earthquake, takes the Anchorage Dispatch Center offline. Dial said the Ketchikan facility also has the ability to facilitate radio communications with local troopers, even if the statewide radio network is disrupted.
So additionally, Ketchikan's equipped with its own separate radio system at the trooper station in case the network, which is called the Alaska Land Mobile Radio System, were to fail.
That comes as the Coast Guard struggles to restore emergency maritime radio communications in some corners of Southeast. The vital VHF Channel 16, which allows mariners to call the Coast Guard for help, has experienced scattered outages throughout Southeast since June. While troopers use a separate radio system, Dial says the local Ketchikan radio network is a good backup in case disaster strikes.
It's kind of a don't put all your eggs in one basket approach.
Troopers don't see it that way. They say there's another dispatch center in Fairbanks currently being upgraded to handle statewide dispatch. In an emailed response to KRBD's request for comment, trooper spokesperson Megan Peters wrote that local knowledge isn't essential to quality dispatch services. For instance, Fairbanks dispatchers currently take calls from Kodiak Island and many places in western Alaska. In addition to the projected cost savings, the email goes on to state that relocating dispatch services to Anchorage would make it easier for the state to hire new employees since the applicant pool would be much larger. Dial says he's hoping to keep at least one dispatcher in Ketchikan to serve as an emergency backup. He says he's working with Ketchikan's state legislative delegation to keep the facility open. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
The Trans-Alaska Pipeline has reached an enormous milestone, 18 billion barrels pumped. KTUU reported yesterday that the amount of oil flowing from Prudhoe Bay to the shipping port of Valdez passed the 18 billion mark last Friday. Pipeline operator Alyeska Pipeline Service Company says $145 billion in revenue from North Slope crude oil has been raised for Alaska. Officials say the pipeline reached 17 billion barrels 5 years ago. The milestone was passed as the Alaska Department of Revenue released a fall revenue forecast with falling projections for oil production. A state oil tax initiative is aimed at raising taxes on legacy fields, which advocates say could help bridge the state's budget deficit. Some oil industry officials say higher taxes have the potential to kill future investment. In 2019, the Arctic did not quite set a record, but Matthew Druckenmiller from the National Snow and Ice Data Center points to a trend.
The average annual surface air temperature over land for 2019 was the second highest since 1900. The six hottest years on record in the Arctic have all taken place in the last 6 years.
Druckenmiller spoke today as the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration released the 2019 Arctic Report Card at a conference in San Francisco. The main takeaway from the report is that the Arctic is rapidly and dramatically changing with continued warming of the air, land, and sea. The report also points out that change brings more change. As permafrost thaws, it releases carbon into the atmosphere as much as 600 million tons a year, as Druckenmiller says.
This thawing of permafrost may now be acting to accelerate global climate change.
A warmer Arctic also means a greener Arctic, but those plants don't suck up enough carbon to balance the increase. Take a close look at those White Castle burgers in your freezer. The restaurant and food chain is recalling some of them because of possible Listeria bacteria. According to the Food and Drug Administration, the bacteria can cause serious or sometimes fatal infections in young children, the elderly, or those with weakened immune systems. It can also cause miscarriages and stillbirths among pregnant women. For healthy people, symptoms include a high fever, severe headache, stiffness, nausea, abdominal pain, and diarrhea. The FDA says retailers are removing from their shelves frozen 6 and 16 packs of White Castle hamburgers with Best Buy dates between August 4th and August 17th of 2020. No one has been reported ill yet, but the FDA says any consumer who purchased the recalled hamburgers should throw them out or take them back to the original store for an exchange or a refund. In a media release, White Castle says a third-party lab detected the bacteria. Company executives say subsequent shipments were stopped and the affected product will be destroyed. They also say they intensively cleaned and sanitized the facility and stepped up food safety training and manufacturing guidelines. Hundreds of people stopped by the governor's mansion in Juneau today for the annual Christmas open house. Before the doors opened, Governor Mike Dunleavy talked with reporters for a few minutes. He didn't answer many questions about the upcoming budget, but he did answer questions about the trays piled high with cookies for the crowds. According to the governor's office, there were about 15,000 cookies and 100 pounds of fudge and chocolate candy. That set the tone for the evening. There wasn't a lot of political talk in that room. And that didn't surprise Juneau resident Becky Allison.
This was about my fourth one I've been to. The last one I went to was when Sarah Palin was in the office. So it's been a few years.
She says she doesn't remember a lot of political talk then, either.
She was a controversial person in herself, but I didn't hear nothing the whole time. Yeah, it was a good visit then, too.
That's it for the KTOO News Update for Tuesday, December 10th, 2019. I'm Jeremy Shea. Thanks for listening.